I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, one of the weirdest theft capers you will ever hear about. The reassembled bones of a T-Rex cousin turned up at an auction house in New York, more than 6,000 miles from where they were unearthed. We'll spend this hour with New Yorker staff writer Paige Williams, who discovered a boom in so-called commercial paleontology, which is to say hunting fossilized remains for sale instead of science. We'll hear why some experts worry commercial hunters will destroy important evidence about ancient life forms, even if they extract unbroken fossils. We'll talk about the laws around the fossil trade and learn how dinosaur remains became the ultimate Hollywood status symbol. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
We're going to start today with a bit of celebrity gossip. A few years ago, the rivalry between actors Nicolas Cage and Leonardo DiCaprio came to a head, literally. These two Hollywood superstars found themselves in direct competition for the well-preserved skull of a T-Rex cousin that roamed the Earth some 70 million years ago, only to end up on the auction block in Manhattan. Bidding went back and forth using anonymous representatives until Cage's guy went up to $276,000. And that was it. Sold to Nicolas Cage, one Tarbosaurus Batar cranium. And then, plot twist, in 2015, Cage gave the giant bone to the government of Mongolia. Turns out it had been stolen. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Paige Williams is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She's been following this story for years and discovered a fascinating cast of characters among those who hunt, buy, and sell fossilized remains around the world. And she discovered another sort of rivalry between scientists who want to carefully control how and when dinosaur bones are brought to the surface and self-proclaimed commercial paleontologists, these guys who are more interested in the market value of these fossils. Williams found so much that she expanded her earlier reporting into a new book called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Paige, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
So this is all complicated from the very start by the fact that some museums are open to buying specimens from these commercial dealers and some want to collect them themselves. What are actual paleontologists looking for when they're digging up fossilized remains besides the bones?
Well, one thing about the purchasing, I should say that tax-funded public natural history museums don't tend to buy off the commercial market. They dig their own. They go searching for their own fossils, and they extract them themselves and usually prep them out themselves. They prepare them in their own labs. And then it's all done very scientifically and in-house, and there's nothing left to chance or to conjecture. What they're looking for when they go out, and then there are private museums, I should say, that that are popping up in other countries that do buy from the commercial market. So they maybe focus more on the aesthetics of the specimen than on the scientific details of the specimen. So you've got those two main buying groups, one main buying group and then one scientific group that doesn't that tends to do their own work. And what they're looking for, it depends on what they're looking for. If they're looking in a Cretaceous bone bed, they may be looking for tyrannosaurs. They may be looking for any creature that might have lived, or plant life remains that lived in the Cretaceous period of the Mesozoic era. If they are in Kansas, for example, they may be looking for the fossils that appeared there when part of the continent was covered with what's called the Western Interior Seaway for tens of millions of years. Every state has sort of its own thing. So it sort of depends on where you are. As I say in the book, that you start hunting depending on what's available to you, depending on where you are. So if you live near badlands, like Cretaceous badlands, you might come across a dinosaur tooth. If you live near along the Jurassic coast of England, for example, you might find lots of ammonites. So it just sort of depends on where you are and what your specialty is. If you're a scientist, if you study early mammals, you would find, and Cretaceous dinosaurs, you would find the Gobi Desert of Mongolia very interesting and appealing in lots of ways.
So you say in the book that fewer than 1% of all the animals who have ever lived have been even partially fossilized. Of course, that's still a lot, but fewer than 1% of the species, I should say, that have lived. Under what conditions does an animal have even a chance of having its remains turned into fossils?
That's a really good question. Somebody asked me this the other day, and it literally silenced me, because it's a simple sounding question with a kind of a complex answer, but I will try to zip it up for you and say that the conditions have to be that you are buried swiftly in sediments that then preserve your remains and keep them away from like scavengers or foul weather that scatters your bones all over the surface of the earth. And then rock layers build up around you, and you groundwater, because bone is porous, groundwater seeps into the bones and eventually turns the bones to rock. So it's kind of a misnomer fewer than 1% become fossils, but that sounds both rare and you were right to say that it's still a lot. So there's a lot out there to be found, but it's still fairly rare conditions that lead to the creation of fossils.
Okay, so most of us picture paleontologists wearing, like khaki vests and shorts and big floppy hats. But a commercial paleontologist can use that title without ever having taken so much as an undergraduate course in paleontology. What sort of people are calling themselves commercial paleontologists these days?
That's right. They, the dealers, a lot of them do. And there's a real divide there there's not a divide in terms of the science. The science is the science. A paleontologist is deeply educated in the sciences and the maths and all of the collateral disciplines that go into studying the history of life on Earth. The commercial guys, I don't know how it got started that they started calling themselves commercial paleontologists, but they sort of justify it by saying that paleontology is the study of fossils and that they are studying fossils. And it's splitting hairs and it's semantics, but they feel totally justified in doing so, even though the scientists say, nope, it took us years to earn the credibility and the credentials to call ourselves paleontologists. We are paleontologists and you are commercial hunters, which has led to some of the I could say class divide between, or ideological divide between, the guys who are out there hunting strictly for commercial purposes and the guys who do this as an academic pursuit.
The central character in your book is this guy, Eric Prokopy. For him, it started with shark teeth when he was a swimmer. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about him.
He grew up in Land O'Lakes, Florida, which is right near Tampa. His father was an elementary school music teacher. His mother was a cafeteria cook and had other jobs and was very entrepreneurial in spirit and in practice and loved to be outside. And so did Eric Prokopy as a child. He was always outside. And Florida is a remarkable place to be outside because it's so lush and there are no dinosaurs there, but it's just absolutely thick with Ice Age creatures, including the megafauna of that time. And his mother would take him around the neighborhood, and they would walk together and ride bikes together and pick things up. Whatever it was that looked interesting, they would pick it up. It might be cans that they would then sell for money. or just anything interesting they took at home. They're all collectors in some way. His father, Bill, collected opera albums. His mother collected beer steins from her native Germany and other things. And Eric, when he picked up his first shark tooth, which was in Venice, Florida, which is down the panhandle and calls itself the shark tooth capital of the world, very interesting place, I found his first shark tooth and just became fascinated with what creature had produced it and how the creature lived and when the creature lived. And then the fact that Venice is just so abundant. There's so many shark teeth in Venice, hence the festival. But it was easy to find them. And he got hooked on natural history just by finding the shark teeth and wondering about the different species of sharks, which then led to collecting shark jaws so that he could compare the species. His initial interest was both driven, I think, by being outdoors, connecting to natural history, and then wondering about the scientific past of each of these animals.
So normally we hear a story about a kid like this and we expect him to study marine biology or paleontology or one of the sciences, but that's not the route that Eric Procopi went.
No, it's not. He ended up going to, he collected all through his childhood. I mean, from the time he was 5 years old, he's never done anything else. This has been truly his life. He ended up going to the University of Florida on partial scholarship, graduated very high in his Land O'Lakes High School class, a smart guy, and went to the University of Florida on a partial academic scholarship and was a swimmer and went on a swim team for a little while until his studies became challenging and he had to give something up. He had a choice between giving up the swim team the fossils, and he chose to give up the swim team and stick with the fossils. And he was studying at Florida engineering, which is no small discipline. It was incredibly hard, and he stuck with that. I asked him once why he didn't study paleontology or some discipline related to it, geology, those types of science. And while he did take those sciences, he didn't pursue that as a discipline. He told me because he didn't like the thought of having to, how do I say this? He didn't want to be an academic. Hmm. He wanted to be independent. He wanted to search for the remains, extinct remains, on his own without having to follow academic procedures and to just live in that academic world that he found, I would imagine, that he found somewhat stifling. He'd always been a pretty independent, free spirit. And I think he also thought that there wouldn't be much of an income in it, in academia. So he did go ahead and graduate with 2 degrees or a double degree in engineering, but then pursued fossils full time. It was all he wanted to do.
So he gets this business going, buying, selling, trading fossils. It's kind of feast or famine. He's got a little family to support, and it seems like they buy a lot of expensive stuff, and then they hold out until, you know, the next big payoff.
Right. And that's the way a lot of the big dealers, I think it's accurate to say that that's a way that a lot of the big dealers live. It is feast or famine. That's what Amanda, Eric's first wife, used to tell people when they would ask about their livelihood. She would say, you know, we do big projects and pay off all our bills and then reinvest in the company. And then, it's tight for a while and then we make another big sale and we're good to go. We pay our people, we pay our bills. we buy, in their case, properties. They were flipping properties because Amanda she's a brilliant designer and she had gotten interested in the idea of flipping old houses and turning them into, income. So they were investing in that. It's a precarious way to live, but it's the way a lot of these guys live.
My guest is Paige Williams. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of a new book called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to get on the line to ask a question or make a comment, you can do that by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or go to Twitter. We are at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with New Yorker staff writer Paige Williams about her book, The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Join us at 800-933-5372. Paige, how does anybody put a dollar value on something as rare as a dinosaur skeleton?
That's a great question. They don't really. They wait for the market in the commercial world. They wait for the market to decide what the value is. So, excuse me. When live auctions started, when venerable auction houses started taking natural history items like fossils and completed dinosaur specimens, they could sort of place a buyer's it's the starting amount, and they would guess at that, and then they would just wait for the market to determine what the ultimate commercial value of something was. And they love that because scientists, of course, hate it because it commercializes the objects that are fundamental to their work and to understanding the history of life on Earth. The commercial guys loved it because they could sort of sit back and see what deep-pocketed buyers would do at a trade show or online or by email blast, which is how they often sold. The price was the price. There was never the possibility that it would rise. But in auctions, they found it exciting that bidders would get into it and start bidding up the price, and winding up with hammer prices that were just out of the realm of anyone's, you know, expectations. It just to pay $5,000 for a tooth, or $10,000, or $15,000 for a single tooth, was unthinkable to a lot. So the live auctions certainly affected the entire market.
So tell us about Tarbosaurus batar. What kind of animal was this?
If you looked at Tarbosaurus batar and T-Rex side by side, you would find it hard, if you're just the average person, to tell the difference between those two animals. They're both apex predators, large carnivores, meat eaters, and both have the huge head, which is like the size of a bathtub, and the long tail that's held off the ground to counterbalance that large head, and then disproportionately small arms. You know, T-Rex gets a bad rap for its little tiny arms. And T. batar had the same little tiny arms. There are some differences. Scientists would tell you that the snout is a little bit narrower on the T. batar. There are more teeth in the T. batar. It was a little bit shorter, but it was a longer animal. But they were definitely at the top of the food chain. And T. batar lived in, it's the Asian cousin of T-Rex. So while T-Rex is found on this continent and predominantly in this country, T. batar has been found in significant portions only in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia.
Okay, so what kind of rules does Mongolia have for hanging on to its natural history treasures?
The rules are very clear. They're clear now. Might not have been clear for a long time, but Mongolia, years ago, decades ago, nationalized its natural resources, and it considers fossils a natural resource. Everything's nationalized, so it's illegal to pick up a fossil, to keep a fossil, to sell a fossil. You can go look around for dinosaurs, but you certainly can't take a hammer and take one out of the ground, and you most certainly can't sell it.
But of course, these things were coming up for sale. And another character in this book is an actual paleontologist, meaning with the PhD from Mongolia, Dr. Minjin. She was working at the American Museum of Natural History. How did she hear about this skeleton up for auction right there in New York where she was living?
Right. Dr. Minjin did her PhD through CUNY, the City University of New York, which is affiliated with the AMNH, with the American Museum of Natural History, which has its own PhD program and is also affiliated with Columbia. So she did her doctoral studies there and happened to be on the Upper West Side near the museum on a day when some news station, I think TV, was running a preview piece about the auction that was coming up in New York City on May 20th, 2012, and saw the specimen, and it was really beautifully photographed and beautifully backlit and very dramatic looking, and she recognized it. It was marketed as a Tyrannosaurus bitar, which was the original scientific name for it. The name was later changed to reflect the difference in species, but the sexier name is the Tyrannosaurus bitar, and a lot of people use that. So she recognized that as bitar as Mongolian. That's her language, her country. That was the desert where her father, a geologist, spent much of his career looking for corals and other things. And she just recognized it immediately as a dinosaur that came from Mongolia. And a lot of these materials had been on the market for a long time. Other people were selling them, but this was the first time somebody had the audacity to bring a fully complete T-Bitar skeleton to market, marketed in such a way. It was very splashy. It was in the glossy auction catalog. It was gorgeous. And the prep work, it was really good. It looked like a museum specimen. I mean, Prokopy had taught himself how to build these things and to you know, weld the armature together to make a lifelike stance and to make a creature that someone would want to look at. So Dr. Minjin called Mongolia. She has a friend who worked in the government who happened to be the aide to the president of Mongolia, and she called her and said, we have to do something, and that's how the whole thing got started.
But this thing was kind of a Frankenstein dinosaur, wasn't it? Made out of spare parts?
Yeah, most dinosaurs are Frankenstein dinosaurs, though. In museums, what people don't understand when they're filing through and looking at these glorious things is that the preppers who work at museums often have to fill in anatomical parts with like parts from either the same species or another species. So this one had I can't remember the percentage. It's in the book. The percentage that's actually one creature. I want to say it was like 70%, and then the rest was fill-in. So he got Gorgosaurus bones from the Black Hills Institute in South Dakota, which is a commercial prep and hunting and excavation company, long time. And he filled in other parts with, you know, like, this may sound funny, but like from the junk drawer, from bones that he had sitting around from similar shipments from Mongolia. I mean, they were Mongolian bones, I believe, but it was not all one creature, which is often the case.
So where was his workshop? I mean, I picture him like out in the garage with the lawnmower just, you know, 3 feet away. Where did he do this work?
He started in the garage. He always had worked in his own garage until he got into dinosaurs and knew that he would need a larger space because these were gigantic creatures. And he at that time lived, he and his wife had restored a glorious old house called Serenola in Gainesville, Florida. And in the backyard beyond the swimming pool. It's kind of a remote area near Payne's Prairie State Park, which is another glorious place. So it's kind of out on its own, and it's sort of wild back there. And he put a 5,000 square foot prefabricated warehouse workshop back there, and there was plenty of room. He could put his boats in there. He could put all his storage, all his tools back there. He planned to build an office. There was enough height in that building to sort of add a second floor upstairs. He was going to put an office up there. It's where he spent most of his time.
He was a workaholic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it was an issue in his marriage sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, this was their main source of income, other than flipping. And you know, flipping is a sort of speculative operation too. You know, fossils speculative, flipping speculative. You need buyers on the back end. You're putting all this work and energy and time and money into something, hoping that somebody's going to be interested in it someday. It's not unlike writing books or you know, doing art or all the other things that you just put your life blood into and then hope that somebody's interested. He was working so hard, and he had so many Mongolian fossils coming in from his supplier in Ulaanbaatar that they were just coming by the caseload. And he had a lot to do, and he wanted to get a lot out the door so that he could pay off debts. He had gotten himself, I don't want to spoil the book for anybody, but he had gotten himself into a little bit of a corner there and was looking for a good payout.
So, Paige, do you have to declare this stuff at the border? Like, when you're importing it, is there a whole bunch of paperwork you're supposed to file out to say that you have fossilized dinosaur remains?
Yeah. You have to say that it's – you have to say – and he did, in some cases, say – label the shipments fossils. But in other cases, dealers have been known to make – misdeclarations on the Customs and Border Protection forms, and on Homeland Security does not like that. They right. want you to tell the truth about what you're bringing into the country, and rightly so. But lots of fossils have gotten through being called, like, quote unquote, samples of craft rock, or one shipment of Chinese fossils came through labeled as shoes. Then there have been dinosaur eggs and all kinds of other things. And sometimes they're labeled, rock, just plain rock. And other times they actually say fossils. But until recently, federal agents didn't really know what to look for. I've been told by federal agents and federal prosecutors that this case has opened their eyes to what to look for. And the Smithsonian actually trains federal agents now, or has trained at least one set of federal agents on how to spot fossils, illicit fossils coming through, and also their significance.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How well did Eric Prokopy know the people that he was dealing with in Mongolia? Once he got to the point where he was trading more than just going out and hunting firsthand, did he know the provenance of the things he was buying?
He knew roughly he knew that they came from the Gobi Desert. He knew the guy who was selling him the fossils, but not very well. Tufshin was his name, and he knew him only by association. He met him through another dealer, met him through email, basically. Emailed him and said, hey, do you have any dinosaurs? And the guy started emailing him photo after photo of dinosaurs in the ground, still in matrix, and in his basement, sort of laid out on tarps and still in boxes. And these were fresh finds, and then finds that he had just stored to sell later, like inventory, like you do if you have a shop. And they didn't know each other very well. Tufshin didn't speak English very well, but his children did, so they could communicate through Tufshin's kids. But they never really – there wasn't really enough time to get to know him very well. Prokopy's first trip to Mongolia was a fleeting one. The second trip, which he took with a friend, lasted longer. It was about 2 weeks, I think. The third one was also fleeting, and not to spoil it, but something unexpected happened, and he had to get on a plane with his new business partner from England and run over to Mongolia, which is easier said than done because it's so far away and hard to get to. But he did it. He jumped on a plane and had to go deal with an unexpected sort of turn of events.
Honestly,
regarding
Paige, reading about all this, it's hard to believe that you can, like, that somewhere in the world there's somebody that you can contact via, like, your Yahoo account and say, hey, do you have dinosaur bones for me?
I mean,
when you were investigating these stories, did it strike you as odd that these precious, precious things, if you know the right people and have enough money, you can acquire them?
Well, anywhere there's desire, motive, means, opportunity, you're going to have a market, whether it's black, gray, legit, otherwise. It's always going to be there. What surprised me was I sort of fell in love with the geopolitical side of this whole thing, because what fascinated me as much as anything else was the fact of how Mongolians turned to fossils as a source of income, legal or illegal, and that had to do with the fall of communism and the rise of the, you know, market society in Mongolia after the fall of communism in 1990, you know, when suddenly everything had a value and everything had a price and people could buy and sell whatever they wanted. And suddenly these taboo objects, bones, you know, these were forbidden objects. The bones of these giant creatures that people came across in the Gobi, nobody touched those. They were considered bad luck. They were considered there was taboo. They were just surrounded by taboo. And then suddenly all these strangers were coming into the desert and taking these objects that nobody else wanted and they had obvious value. So a lot of the crews who were hired on to help dig dinosaurs and other fossils knew how to jacket the fossils, knew how to, you know, they learned how, where to find them, how to look for them, how to get them out, and knew that they could sell them. So, you know, where there's opportunity and education and desire, you're going to have people, and where there's a need to survive, which is what was happening in a lot of cases here, it's going to happen.
And so this illicitly sold, illicitly marketed fossil that Dr. Minjin raised the red flag on became not just like an international controversy, but it became a major issue in Mongolian presidential elections.
It did. The president of Mongolia, President Elbegdorj, was a very popular republic. Not how to say this easily. When communism fell in Mongolia, a cast of Americans went over to Mongolia and helped train politicians in what are basically Republican style politics. And Republican style politics may not be the correct term, but these are American Republicans going over to train them in like campaign messaging and campaign strategy and how to get your name out and how to appeal to voters, which of course was new.
Let me have you pause right here. And you can pick up this story in just a minute. My guest is Paige Williams. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New Yorker staff writer Paige Williams, who's just published a book called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. You were saying before the break, Paige, that some U.S. Republicans went to Mongolia to train folks there after the end of communism in how to run a democracy. Hence you have had the president at the time of Mongolia at the time that this fossil became an issue.
Right. I, as we were taking the break, I just jotted notes to try to the cause and effect here is a little bit complicated, but I think I can boil it down. The James Baker, when he was Secretary of State of the United States, had gone over once democracy was, they were on a path to democracy in Mongolia, to reiterate the United States' support for Mongolia. Because Mongolia, as we all know, is situated between Russia and China and has long been a friend of North Korea. So he proposed that the U.S. become a third, quote-unquote, third neighbor to Mongolia, meaning you have, you know, if everything goes right and if you are, in fact, you know, if you pursue this democracy thing in the right way, then we will be essentially your friend and we will support you financially and otherwise. And so the president, this president, Elbeg Dorje, he was, he had been the prime minister, he had been educated at Harvard, he had started the first democratic slash independent newspaper in, the first independent newspaper in Mongolia, had been a journalist during his early days and wrote poetry for an army newspaper. And he was their guy. But when he was up for re-election, he had become sort of mired in this scandal, a couple of scandals, but one involving the arrest and corruption allegations surrounding the former president of the country, and an arrest that caught the eye of the world because a lot of people, including Senator Dianne Feinstein and others, found this to be problematic and someone called it old Russia. These tactics are old Russia tactics, and this is not what democracy is supposed to look like. And so he was looking for a win. He was looking for the vote of the people and the love of the people, and wanted his next win because it was essential to stay in power so that they would have all of parliament, all including the mayor and the mayor of UB, Ulaanbaatar, and everything sort of in hand. And so it was essential that he win. And when Dr. Mengjin called President Elbeg Dorje's aide and the aide, Oyuna, went to him, she said, "Bring this dinosaur back to Mongolia and you can be the hero." The name Batar translates to hero in Mongolian, but she told him, "You bring this dinosaur back to Mongolia and you can be the hero." And sure enough, the dinosaur went back right before the election. A big pop-up museum went in UB right there on the main square. And part of the display involved U.S. legal documents that had Elbeg Dorje's name on them that had been carefully crafted by his Texas attorney, Robert Painter, who's from Houston, and had handled the case, had never handled a dinosaur case, but handled this one really well and quickly. And the documents from that case were then presented to the Mongolian public as, look, here's evidence of our president doing something important. And there's even the sense that there were people cheering that Mongolia, little Mongolia, had managed to take back something important from a superpower. So that was the connection, and he won.
What obligation does an auction house have to demonstrate the right that it can sell a given object, and how are they supposed to prove that?
That's a really good question in terms of natural history. In terms of fossils in particular, they're supposed to do due diligence. And what they said in this case was that they had, quote-unquote, papers from, the sellers. There were no papers from the sellers. There were invoices. There were customs papers, but there is no provenance for a fossil. There's not, you know, it's not like with art where you can often trace it back to, you know, there's a clear lineage there. That simply doesn't exist with fossils because they are fundamentally scientific objects in the eyes of science. You know, no one was checking. There's still no one that really holds auction houses accountable for this kind of checking. The industry is not regulated, and for better or worse, and it's largely self-policing. And, you know, after this Brokopi case, a lot of auction houses got out of the natural history sector altogether. They're creeping back into it now, but for a while, you know, they scrubbed all their websites of mentions of this kind of thing, and went dark on it. But they're sort of easing back into it. And there's no oversight, and there's no, you know, it's up to them to make sure that the materials they're dealing in are legit materials.
So what does like Leonardo DiCaprio or Nicolas Cage need with a complete dinosaur skeleton to put up in their living room? Do they just have more money than they know what to do with? Are they intending to give these to museums at some point down the road?
I truly don't know. I think that both of them, I mean, Nicolas Cage is a famous collector. He collects lots of things. I think comic books and some other stuff. So this might have just fed part of his, you know, fascination with collecting in general. DiCaprio is, as we know, is very big into conservation and the environment. And I don't know, perhaps he liked having reminders of the world around us and of the fact that we're all going to be toast someday, just right there in his living room. I don't know. A lot of collectors like having access to stunning pieces right on hand so that they don't have to go to a museum and look at them. You know, when they became aware that they could just buy this stuff instead of having to go to a museum to see it, that's when some of the market picked up.
It raises really interesting questions because on the one hand, I completely empathize with scientists who say, just please leave this to the professionals. And I also, you know, there's a reasonable argument to be made that, listen, if you want to pay enough money to have this thing, then that's the kind of, that's what capitalism does.
Yeah, and that divide is not, that divide has been there for a really long time, decades, generations, and they've not been able to come together on how to navigate those two very separate worlds. It's been pretty hostile at times, but scientists, paleontologists don't deny that commercial hunters and amateur / independent, whatever you want to call them, hunters, the science wouldn't exist without them. That's how natural history museums started. That's how the science evolved, with everyday people out there looking at the world around them and picking up objects and wondering what they are and what made them and when they lived and how they lived and why they died. Their finds are in the major glorious natural museum histories of the world. Those aren't all scientist finds. Those are amateur finds. Those are everyday people finds. So, you know, I hope someday will be some sort of bridge between those worlds where they acknowledge each other. Every now and then you start to see scientists including amateur or independent hunters in their papers that they write when they're describing new finds or they're describing their work. You'll see an acknowledgement of the non-scientist in that work. But, you know, Mary Anning is a perfect example of that. She was the teenage fossil hunter on the Jurassic coast of England in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and she was just this poor teenager who was out looking for fascinating stuff and selling fossils to the scientists who came down to work out this new science of geology and to work out this new theory of evolution. And it took generations for her to be acknowledged at all. And she's one of the most important fossil hunters who ever lived.
Was she brushed aside because she was female?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My guest is Paige Williams. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm sorry, you were saying, of course, that's why nobody paid attention initially.
Well, that and her and the class divide. Mm-hmm. So the she was not only female, she was poor, and she was basically supporting her family as a fossil hunter on this gloriously unstable beach. If you've ever been to Lyme Regis or Charmouth, England, it's just a stunning, it's a magical place because it's so rich with fossils and especially, you know, Mary found some of her, we would need a whole other hour for Mary Anning. I'm obsessed with Mary Anning. So her finds are in the Natural History Museum in London, finally under her name and under the one portrait of her that exists. And I don't think many people know about her. And I put her in the book because this is a a science, you know, women still have trouble in science in terms of numbers and all kinds of other things. But it's also true of the independent hunter side that it's a guy's world in a lot of cases. And so she's one of the ones who really truly contributed to the understanding of the history of this planet that we're living on, and who is finally starting to be recognized for her unlikely achievements. I mean, she taught herself how to read and write. She, you know, she did everything she could do to try to communicate with Cuvier as he was working out his theories. Excuse me, I've been talking a lot lately. and anyway, she's just, I think she's a heroic figure. And she's one of many.
So I almost hesitate to ask you this because I don't know what the answer is going to be. I bought at a rock shop a few years ago an Ammonite. It's about the size of a saucer, and I not only love it, but I love it so much that I want 10 more. Should I feel bad about owning this piece of natural history?
Ammonites are my favorite. Ammonites are my absolute favorite. So that's a good choice, number one. Do you know where it came from?
I don't.
Did it have any?
It came from a rock shop in Colorado, as far as I know, but I know that's not where it was unearthed.
I doubt it had any. Was it like in a box with other ammonites?
No, it was just in a display case. I mean, it wasn't. It was like $70, so I don't think it's like a priceless object. Listen, yeah. To me justifying my purchase of a precious piece of natural history.
That's fine. As long as it came from, and there's no way to know, because once it's out of the ground, there's absolutely no tracing that you can do. There's some scientists who are working on matching rare trace elements to actual holes in the ground, but there's no real link between the thing you're seeing on the shelf and the hole in the ground or whatever, wherever it came from. In that case, you know, if it was found in the United States has interesting laws in that if you find a fossil on your own property or on property where you have permission to hunt, then it's yours. You can do whatever you want to with it. You can sell it, keep it, burn it, whatever. Doesn't matter what it is, how big it is, how new it is, how undiscovered it is, it's yours. But you can't take stuff from federal property, and you can't take stuff from other people, obviously. So as long as it was sourced properly, that's 100% legit. Most of the fossils out there are 100% legit. It's just that one fragment of the trade that pushes boundaries and that takes risks where it shouldn't.
Did you spend any time observing or assisting digs that were taking place in all these spots in the world that you visited?
Observing, but not participating. I feel like it's my job as a journalist to watch and not to get involved and not to come down on the side of not to come down on any side, really. I'd rather the reader read all the facts and come to a decision on his or her own. Early on, when I was looking for a way to write about this world, I didn't start with Prokopi in his case. I started with the case of another commercial outfit. It was a group of people, a small group of people, digging out a juvenile T-Rex in Harding County, South Dakota, which bills itself as the T-Rex capital of the world. And I spent a photographer friend of mine and I went out there and spent, I don't know, a couple of weeks, 10 days, something like that, watching those guys dig that look for the rest of that skeleton. And then we also went to watch the Casper, Wyoming Tate Museum crew dig out a fully grown T-Rex in Lusk, Wyoming. They both were fascinating. They were very different. The museum dig was very controlled and very methodical. The commercial dig, you know, there was a guy yelling, "Show me the bone! Show me the bone!" And they, you know, they had a backhoe, and it was a little bit different. But there was a scientist attached to that dig, but it was still quite different.
Paige Williams is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Dinosaur Artist: Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Paige, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for making time for us.
I enjoyed this so much. Thank you so much, Chris.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app. When you do, please leave us a review. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.